welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week, Christians from around the world celebrate Christmas, the last Christmas of the millennium. What better time to examine Jesus as apocalyptic prophet, which is exactly what we will do in a moment when we talk to Bart Ehrman, author of a recently published book on the subject. But before we do that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. Recalling the fate of the late Tsar of Russia, Nicholas II, and his family, this week marks the 10-year anniversary of the murder of Romanian communist leader Nicolae Ceaușescu and his wife, Elena. Beginning in 1967, when he was elected by the Grand National Assembly as president of the State Council of the Socialist Republic of Romania, Ceaușescu subjected the Romanian people to treatment comparable to that of Joseph Stalin's brutality during the building of a modern Soviet state. While his first years in office offered Romania a voice on the world stage, culminating in Ceaușescu's boycott of the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968, the 70s and 80s revealed the communists' true dictatorial colors. In hope of building a communist country comparable to Russia, Ceaușescu undertook a massive industrialization of the country. In the process, his government herded millions of peasants and middle-class workers into drab, concrete, high-rise buildings, while he and his wife lived opulently in a building called the People's Palace. During the last years of his rule, millions of Romanians lived without any heat or electricity, forced to loot for their survival, and their hatred of the communist leader grew, culminating in his assassination this week in 1989. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, yet another controversy has arisen surrounding the infamous outlaw Jesse James. This one, however, is dividing the family of his supposed survivors. In her new book, Betty Dorsett Duke of Liberty Hill, Texas, claims that her great-great-grandfather, James Courtney, was really Jesse James, that James faked his murder and retired to Texas, where he died in 1951. And she bolsters her argument with diary entries, photographs, and other personal belongings. Byron Courtney, James Courtney's grandson, however, begs to differ and offers evidence in support of his position as well. Unfortunately for Duke, a judge recently denied her request to exhume Courtney's body for DNA testing, so the matter will likely go unresolved. The planned destruction of Cold War missile silos in Langdon, North Dakota, in adherence to the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, is making some local residents recall their history. Built in the 1960s by the Air Force to house nuclear-tipped Minuteman III missiles, each silo will be laced with over 800 pounds of dynamite and destroyed at the rate of one per week. While many local residents in the 1960s saw the silos as a threat, making their town one of the first locations targeted in the event of a nuclear war, others saw them as a form of necessary national security. In response to a local dairy farmer's concern in 1962 about the effects that a launch would have on his nearby cows, an Air Force worker underscored the significance of the silos. If these missiles are launched, the milk cows will be the least of your problems. You're listening to Talking History. This week, Christians around the world celebrate another Christmas. They celebrate once again the birth of Jesus. In the past, in recognition of this significant event, we at Talking History have looked at the historical Jesus and the history of Christmas. But this Christmas is also the last Christmas of the millennium, providing us with the perfect opportunity to examine Jesus as apocalyptic prophet of the new millennium, a case made most recently by our guest today, Bart Ehrman, in a highly regarded and controversial book titled Jesus, Apocalyptic Prophet of the New Millennium, published by Oxford University Press. Professor Ehrman is Bowman and Gordon Gray Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Welcome, Professor Ehrman, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So did Jesus really preach that the world as we know it was about to come to an end?
Yeah, I think he did. He anticipated that the world was going to end within his own generation.
within his lifetime or the generation after his death? Or
well, it's not clear whether he thought he himself would be alive when it came, but he did tell his disciples that some of them would still be alive when it came. So it's not clear whether he knew he was going to be put to death or not, but he certainly thought that his disciples would be alive when the kingdom of God arrived.
Now, this is something that most of us don't hear much about in church on Sundays. How long have we known about this, and why don't we hear more about it?
Well, a lot of Christians care a lot about it because a lot of Christians still think that the world's going to end soon, and they can base their beliefs on what Jesus himself said, because Jesus appears to have thought something quite similar to that. Scholars have known that Jesus taught that for a long time. The first person to popularize the view was Albert Schweitzer, the great medical missionary, who wrote a book in 1906 called The Quest of the Historical Jesus, in which he showed pretty convincingly that Jesus, like a lot of his Jewish contemporaries, thought that God was soon going to intervene in history and overthrow the forces of evil and bring in a kingdom, which would be an entirely new thing, so that societies, he knew it, would be overthrown. He didn't think that the world itself would blow up, but he did think that what we thought of as the world, everything in our experience, would disappear and that a new kingdom would come.
Now, a lot of this seems to be based on what you said earlier, referred to earlier, is what Jesus said. How do we know what he said? What are the sources of this information?
Well, that's a particularly difficult issue. Most people, of course, assume that you can simply read the New Testament, where you have four Gospels, and take the words of Jesus found in these four Gospels and know exactly what Jesus said. Scholars, though, for a long time have realized that the Gospels, the New Testament, however valuable they may be as religious documents of faith, are problematic for historians because they have so many differences among themselves that it's difficult to know in places whether Jesus actually said the words that are attributed to him. And so scholars have to devise methods for looking at the Gospels to discern which of them would be more accurate and which words recorded in these books are ones that actually go back to Jesus. We're unfortunately not helped very much by the fact that we don't have good sources outside of the New Testament to assist us in knowing what Jesus actually said, although there are a number of other Gospels that survive. Most of them aren't of much use to us, and there aren't very many references to Jesus in other writers from the period either. So for the most part, we're restricted to the four Gospels of the New Testament. But since these have so many differences among themselves and are so far removed in date from the events that they narrate, it's difficult often to know what they record is accurate and what isn't accurate.
Now, what particular sources or perhaps Gospels did you rely on for your research and conclusions here?
Well, I looked at every source that survives from the ancient world. What people need to realize is that the only way to know about a person from the past is if there are sources contemporary with him or her that tell us something about them. Unfortunately, Jesus is never mentioned by any Roman or Greek author for the entire first century after the first century of the Common Era. So that the only sources that mention Jesus would be the Christian sources of the New Testament, and then one Jewish source, the ancient Jewish historian Josephus. We do have a few references to Jesus in other sources later than that, in the early second century, but nothing earlier. There are also some other Gospels that I mentioned. The one that scholars have been most attracted to was one that was discovered just within the last 50 years, the famous Gospel of Thomas, which records 114 sayings of Jesus, but some of which aren't found in the New Testament. But by and large, the evidence we have for what Jesus said and did comes from the New Testament, from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Among those four, most scholars would agree that the Gospel of John was the final one to be written, and is so different from the other three that it looks like it has a completely different spin on who Jesus was. And so I think probably most scholars would rely on Matthew, Mark, and Luke to give us a good account of Jesus. And those are the books, of course, that show Jesus predicting that there's a end of the age coming in which God will overthrow the forces of evil and set up his kingdom.
So you rely primarily on Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
Matthew, Mark, and Luke primarily, but there's a source that was behind two of these Gospels, Matthew and Luke, a source that a lot of people know about that scholars have called Q, provide Matthew and Luke for some of their sayings, and so that's another source, but the only way to get to that source is by studying Matthew and Luke.
Now, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that Q doesn't actually exist. You kind of piece it together by looking at the first two Gospels?
That's right. Well, the first three Gospels. The hypothesis is that since Matthew, Mark, and Luke agreed so much among themselves, that they must have had the same sources of information because they have exact word-for-word agreements in places, but then differences in other places. And most scholars think that Matthew and Luke used Mark as one of their sources. But then for stories that aren't found in Mark, there must have been some other source available to Matthew and Luke. And since it doesn't look like Matthew or Luke used the other, then scholars have hypothesized the existence of this unavailable source, Q.
I see. So you look for common ground and then extract from that what you think was probably said in Q.
That's right.
Okay. How much material were you able to use from the time, for example, let me rephrase this perhaps, was Jesus sort of original and different in his apocalyptic vision? Is there any context in which you could work in determining his views here?
Yeah, I think context is extremely important. I think it doesn't make sense to think that Jesus was somebody who had a message that made that was so different that nobody would have understood it in his own context. And we know a lot now about the context of Jesus because of discoveries like the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls are documents that also have an apocalyptic vision of the world in which it's thought that the world was soon going to end. I think that that's the context within which Jesus makes the most sense. There are, of course, differences for everybody who has an apocalyptic point of view, and Jesus himself had some distinctive aspects to his proclamation. But the basic idea that he thought that history, as it was going on then, was soon to come to an end, is something that was shared by a number of Jews in the first century.
Okay, so if he's not alone in his apocalyptic views, what would you say was unique to his particular idea?
Well, it's a little bit hard to isolate anything that is especially unique because virtually everything that Jesus says can be found in other Jewish writings from the period. There are some things that would make him distinctive, though, if not unique. In other words, he was saying things that made his message stand out, even though other people were saying very similar things. One thing that shook up a lot of his contemporaries was that he maintained that when the end of the age came, there was going to be a cosmic judge who came from heaven, someone that he called the Son of Man, probably a reference to a figure that we know about from the Hebrew Bible, Daniel chapter 7. The Son of Man would come on the clouds of heaven and bring destruction to the enemies of God. One of the things that was distinctive of Jesus' proclamation, though, was that Jesus included the religious leaders of his own people, the Jewish people, as among those who would be destroyed when the Son of Man arrived, and that the temple in Jerusalem, which was the very center of religious life for Judaism, would be destroyed in this coming onslaught. Some people have taken that message to mean that Jesus was anti-Jewish, which I strongly think isn't the case at all. There have always been Jewish prophets who made a proclamation against the Jewish people and against, not the Jewish people, a proclamation against the Jewish leaders and against Jewish institutions. And they weren't seen as being standing in opposition to Judaism or the Jewish people per se. In fact, most of the prophets in the Hebrew Bible are of that sort. And so Jesus was that kind of apocalypticist, one who thought that the end was coming. It would bring destruction to God's enemies, but some of the leaders of the Jews were among the enemies.
This is a pretty strong message, and I would imagine that different groups, let's say within the first century, would have treated it differently. Let me sort of ask you a three-part question here and let you respond. First of all, from what you can tell, how did his listeners, so to speak, respond? Then, secondly, how would people have responded immediately upon his death, and then perhaps later in the century as the church was trying to establish itself?
Well, some of the listeners obviously appreciated the message and agreed with it. There's some reason to think that people who were not in power were especially attracted to a message that taught that those who were in power were going to be taken down, and that those who were now oppressed and poor and outcast would be given positions of authority in the coming kingdom. And so there's some things to suggest that Jesus' followers were largely lower-class people who were attracted to this kind of message. People of the upper classes, of course, often take offense at this kind of message because, of course, they're the ones with the power. And if someone proclaims those in power will be taken out of power and will be destroyed, that obviously isn't a comfortable message. It's not an accident that it was the powerful who decided that Jesus was to be taken out of the way and then arranged for him to be crucified. So his message obviously brought mixed results. One of the results, I think, was his own crucifixion. After his death, his followers continued to maintain an apocalyptic message, thinking that the end of time was near. They changed some of the things he said, though, because they came to believe that this Son of Man who was coming on the clouds of heaven in judgment would be none other than Jesus himself. They believed this because they thought that he had been raised from the dead and exalted to heaven, and since that's where the Son of Man is coming from, then they just assumed that that would be Jesus himself, which is why the earliest Christians thought that Jesus had come the first time to die and the second time he would come in judgment, and so Christians started talking about the return of Christ from heaven.
Well, okay, we switch now to an imminent second coming of Jesus. Now, when it wasn't so imminent, when decades went by and he didn't reappear, the church must have found this problematic and had to adjust to this.
Yeah, exactly. That's why, in response to your earlier question, why people don't talk about this message today in most churches, it's precisely because what the earliest believers had thought was going to happen simply didn't. And years went by, and then decades, and they had to adjust their thinking somewhat and start reinterpreting some of the things Jesus had said. So the Christians stopped talking about the end of the age and the coming kingdom of God and started thinking about the kingdom of God as a kingdom of heaven, a place that people would go to when they die rather than when the Son of Man appeared on the clouds of heaven. And so this was a kind of a transformation of Jesus' own original message to his disciples.
I would imagine that the message was transformed repeatedly, but just to jump ahead, because we're running out of time here, how would you say that modern prophets could subscribe to what Jesus had to say, or was it markedly different from what we're hearing today?
Well, of course, there are a lot of prophets today who would say that the end is imminent, and they can quote Jesus' own words, because Jesus himself thought that it was imminent. But when Jesus thought it was imminent, he didn't think that it would happen in the year 2000 or the year 2001. He thought it was going to happen within his own generation. I think people in new contexts always need to reinterpret past traditions and to make them applicable to their new situations. And so people who simply take over Jesus' words and say, yes, the end is going to happen right away, I think have misunderstood that those words were spoken in a particular first century context, and they can't be taken over without remainder into our own period.
Well, building on that, because the term millennium can refer to a thousand year and a calendar date, or it can refer to the biblical in sense of millennium. In the title of your book, Apocalyptic Prophet of the New Millennium, what did you intend by new in the context?
Well, I meant it to be an ironic title, because Jesus thought the new age was coming, and we ourselves are moving into a new age. It just so happens, though, that the new age Jesus anticipated isn't the one that we're moving into. Jesus expected that the kingdom of God would arrive from heaven and there'd be a utopian place on earth, God's own kingdom where people would live and there'd be no more sin and there'd be no more hatred or war or disease or death. And this would be a perfect kind of existence here. That never happened, course, but we ourselves are moving into a new millennium, which, like the old one, has new possibilities opening up for us. And so I meant it in an ironic sense, that Jesus expected the new millennium in his age, and we ourselves are moving into a new one now.
Well, we certainly are, and we'll soon find out what that means to all of us, but we're out of time for today, and thank you, Professor Ehrman, for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to Bart Ehrman, Bowman, and Gordon Gray Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and the author of Jesus, Apocalyptic Prophet of the New Millennium, published by Oxford University Press. You're listening to Talking History. In place of our regular op-ed of the week for this, our special Christmas show, we've decided to let our listeners speak, to tell us what Christmas means to them. Here's what they had to say.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light.
When I think of Christmas, the first thing that comes to mind is family. And I think that's especially important to me right now because I'm caring for both my parents, and I see the aging happening where before they were, it was timeless. And I guess I see a changing in family structure. We are aging and becoming the elders for our youngsters. It gives me great hope for the future that we will continue and that we have left a legacy.
When I think of Christmas, it's just an opportunity for me to be with my family, to not think about work at all, and just spend fun times enjoying the love and the warmth of my family. That's the most important to me.
I can remember anticipating, you know, not being able to sleep that whole night, waiting to, you know, to get the gifts or to wait to see if the cookies were eaten. The mysterious aspect of Christmas is gone, but I think it, as you get older, you kind of replace it with something more meaningful if you look for it.
Christmas to us is, it's the season of giving. It's also when Christ was born. That's the most important part to us.
Well, when I think about Christmas, I think about family first, because obviously means a lot to me. My grandmother comes to our house every Christmas, and she's 90 years old, and me being 8,000 miles away, I got off of work for 2 weeks to fly home, because being 90, you never know how long she has left with us, and you know, my family means the most to us, Christmas is concerned.
Christmas really is a time of getting together with family. When I was little, it was more into presents and that kind of stuff, but as I got older, I realized the real meaning and being religious through Christ and that kind of stuff, and just kind of family and friends is the most important part, and being together and sharing experiences and time with them.
Well, I don't know that we're planning anything special for the millennium, but to me, Christmas is all about the kids and the spirit of the season and the looks on their faces and the lights, and just everything is beautiful and it's wonderful. It's my favorite time of year.
We'll have to
For our Christmas site of the week, we take you to the place where it all began. And here to tell you about that place is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Located about 6 miles south of Jerusalem is the town of Bethlehem. Once exclusively populated by Christians, it is now a mix of Christian and Muslim Palestinians. Bethlehem is the home of the Nativity Church, built above the cave where Jesus is said to have been born. Even though Western teachings mention the birth of Jesus in a manger, the poor families in Bethlehem during the 2nd century used the region's rocky hollows as dwellings and stables, making the early Christian tradition, which places the nativity scene in a cave, plausible. The original Nativity Church was built in AD 23, but nothing remains of the first buildings except the nave and its four rows of columns. Located near the church is the Milk Grotto, where according to tradition, the Holy Family stayed before fleeing. And not far from there are the Shepherd's Fields, where it is believed the shepherds of the Nativity came. Every year, Bethlehem is filled with Christian pilgrims, and the city is busiest on Christmas Eve with the traditional Christmas Mass.
And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. Everyone knows that the poinsettia is the Christmas plant, but how many of you know its history and how it came to be under your tree or mantle during the holiday season? This you can learn from an exhibition and a series of events at the U.S. National Arboretum Administration Building in Washington, D.C. The exhibit closes on January 2nd, but be sure to call the Arboretum for information on the series. And for those of you who insist on a little history mixed with your holiday fair, tune in the History Channel between now and the end of the month for a series of holiday history shows. On December 22nd, watch History of the Holidays, Christmas Unwrapped, a history of the holiday traditions we've come to love. On Christmas Day, while your children unwrap their presents, watch the history of toys and games, a nostalgic and informative look at the things that amused us and our ancestors as children. And on December 30th, get a head start on your New Year's celebration by looking at New Year 2000, Centuries of Celebration, which examines the history of our welcoming the new year on January 1st and other dates in the calendar in the West and elsewhere in the world. Be sure to check your local listings for exact times. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you have enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week when the staff of Talking History will join me in looking back at the momentous events of the past 1,000 years as we bring the millennium to a close. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. And until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
On the first day of Christmas, I took a little bit of a heart.